This is Functional Medicine Update for October 2003, Volume 23, Number 10. This month we'll review research on cellular signaling. Our guest interview will be with Dr. Michael Hollick discussing vitamin D. We'll begin our issue with a look at phenomics, specific signals within specific tissues. We'll also revisit the subject of maintaining bone reserve and consider signal transduction activators in various diseases. We'll complete the first half of this issue with PPAR cell signaling molecules. Following our interview with Dr. Hollick, we'll close up this issue with a discussion of first and second signal messengers. Now with this issue of Functional Medicine Update, here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for October 2003. It might seem a little premature for you to think about the symposium for 2004, but for those of us who sit around and ponder these things and are responsible for putting together the continuing medical education program, it's never too early to start thinking about these things. And so I wanted to be the first to give you some information about where the Institute for Functional Medicine is heading for its 2004 year and emphasis. And I believe you'll be very pleased because it comes out of many of the responses that we got back from the recipients and participants of information and programs from the IFM, particularly our Tucson 10th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. And that was to focus on aspects of this pandemic called type 2 diabetes and its origin, its interrelationship with other disorders of age-related disease etiology, and how we get into effective management programs, starting with children all the way up through adults. So we're going to be putting together what I think will be seen as a world-class roster of plenary speakers and workshop facilitators to speak to this topic from a functional medicine perspective across disciplines from both the basic science, clinical research, and clinical implementation perspectives. You'll hear more about the program and its participants and presenters over the course of the next month or two, but I just wanted to get you to put a date on your calendar, hold it as a date fixed, and that's May 11th through 15th, 2004 in Vancouver, British Columbia. We've had very good feedback from our symposium that we held in Vancouver, British Columbia 3 years ago at the Westin International Resort right next to Stanley Park, beautiful venue, and we will be returning there again for the 11th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, May 11th through 15th, 2004, with a focus on the pandemic of type 2 diabetes. Now, with that in mind, over the course of the next several months in Functional Medicine Update, I'm going to try to bring some of these topics into discussion so that those of you who do attend the symposium will be hopefully well prepared to take full advantage of that topic. And those of you that are not going to the symposium for whatever that reason might be, you'll at least have gotten some of the information that we would be including and focusing on as part of the symposium. This month, therefore, we're very pleased to actually take on a topic which, through our clinician slash researcher of the month, may appear to be very oblique and only tangentially connected to the topic of type 2 diabetes, and that has to do with vitamin D physiology and its relationship to medicine and disease. You might find that connection to vitamin D to chronic age-related diseases other than osteoporosis to be not so obvious, but I think by the time you have heard the eloquent presentation by our clinician slash researcher of the month, Dr. Michael Hollick. Michael Hollick is a primary investigator in the area of vitamin D physiology and medicine for over 25 years, and you're going to get news to use from Dr. Hollick that is really very, very valuable. With that in mind, then, let me point the direction finder for this month's Functional Medicine Update, looking at the long-term objective of trying to better understand the etiology of type 2 diabetes through cellular signaling processes. Now, cellular signaling is becoming one of the more hot topics in basic science and physiology research. It's a topic that each day new information comes available that better helps us to both understand the importance of these signaling processes, signal transduction as it's so called, but also to understand and appreciate the complexity. This is a process that occurs in differential ways in different cell types, different tissues, and different organs. Therefore, one cannot talk just about global cell signaling. You need to talk about specific processes within specific organs or organ systems or tissues that then gives rise to specific functional or phenotypic changes. In fact, there's a new term that's emerging in medicine. You've heard me use the term genomics and proteomics and metabolomics, but now it's phenomics. Phenomics, that's spelled with a P, P-H-E-N-O-M-I-C-S, is the relationship of how all this works out, the interrelationship between gene expression and mRNA translation into protein, and how proteins then control function, and then how metabolism ultimately gives rise to the outcome in the cell, and then how that all works together to give rise to the observable, what we see in that patient or in that organ or organ system, as the phenomic outcome. And in fact, we will be talking indirectly, obviously, about phenomics, because phenomics assumes then a functional change in the organism that is a consequence of the admixture or interrelationship among metabolomic, proteomic, and genomic factors. Now, I know this is a pretty heavyweight thing to start off the block here in this month's Functional Medicine Update, but I believe from that context, you will better understand not only what Dr. Hollick is going to speak to later in this month's issue, but also where we're trying to take this discussion over the next several months in harnessing these discoveries that are being made around signal transduction and cell signaling into clinically applied procedures that personalize treatment to the individual need and improve, obviously, patient outcomes. Now, that's a big mouthful and a lot of promise, and obviously then we're going to have to deliver on that promise, and we'll have to do it together collectively over the next several months stepwise. And this month I'll start down that path by looking at some of the cell signaling interrelationships that connect together bone, brain, heart, kidney, colon, prostate, and breast. Now, those seem like strange bedfellows to be all connected. This is like the knee bone connected to the ankle bone type of discussion, how we make all these particular interconnections. But I think through cell signaling, we start to understand there are shared physiological processes that are seen in phenomics that may become the sentinel systems that we want to, or let's call it the fulcrum. Remember what Atlas said about putting the right lever at the right place, you can move the earth. And so maybe we want to make sure that we're putting our lever at the right place with regard to these systems. With that in mind, let me, if I can, start with a condition that you all know something about, osteoporosis. You know, it's a very significant concern, particularly in women as they go through the menopause for Cole's fracture, for spinal compression fracture, and for the disability that ultimately can land them in the hospital, for which then one of the major outcomes is death itself. Many people who end up in the hospital from spontaneous fracture to osteoporosis never leave the hospital. And therefore, it's considered the 11th to the 7th cause of death in the older age population. So it's not of insignificance, and it's more than just an orthopedic problem. We've often said that the understanding of the etiology of osteoporosis is to better understand the interrelationship between skeletal mass and the appendicular skeleton and how the various forms of bone are either resorbed or remade in this dynamic process of equilibrium, the so-called osteolysis and osteogenesis equilibrium, and that bone cell mass, or sometimes called bone cell reserve or bone reserve, is a very important characteristic to want to maintain as we go into older age. Bone reserve basically is a skeletal mass that would be that above one needs to keep intact in order to withstand the normal wear and tear of life. Every time you twist or turn or stumble or trip, you put strain on your skeleton that has to mobilize the reserve, right? The tensile strength, like a bridge that's put a load on the bridge. It has a reserve. As your bone reserve is compromised over time, then those stresses and strains that your skeleton is subjected to, which are inevitable, may have less reserve. This is like organ reserve, the James Freeze model that we have talked about so many times in functional medicine. So eventually, if you go what's called below the threshold, the zone of fracture, then those simple daily mechanical things that you put up with every day, never think about them, now may exceed the resiliency of your bone, mechanical resistance, and now you get a spontaneous fracture. So it's not the older person who falls down and breaks their hip. It's the other way around generally. It's the older person who breaks their hip and then falls down because the normal strength of the bone has been so compromised that it can't respond to the stresses and strains of daily living, a trip or a stumble. So you want to maintain a high skeletal reserve, a high skeletal mass. And then you ask, okay, how do you do that? Well, you have to build it in younger years. We know that because once you get it, you're going to try to hold on to it. But if you don't get that reserve, you don't get the reserve in your bank account. When you try to retire, you don't have many reserves, right? That's the analogy. So you try to build your bone mass as a youth with the appropriate exercise and nutrition lifestyle. Then you try to hold on to it. This is a classic model of functional aging, the whole functional medicine concept, the organ reserve concept. Now, how do you do that? Well, you have to look at the dynamics of calcium into the bone, calcium out of the bone, the hydroxyapatite matrix, the proteinaceous skeletal framework upon which the calcium hydroxyapatite phosphate is crystallized. And in order to do that, there are many complex factors, as you know, that play a role in that balance, not just calcium nutrition itself. It has to do with the nature by which the protein is synthesized, the anabolic and catabolic factors that lead to protein synthesis and degradation. It also relates to the whole nature of how calcium moves into cells and magnesium moves out of cells, knowing that there is this calcium-magnesium dynamic. We know that there is a very strong endocrine relationship through the parathyroid and through the thyroid gland. We know there's a gastrointestinal absorption component with calcium-binding protein and the absorption of calcium. We know that there is a relationship, obviously, to various hormonal factors that are related to aspects of this bone remodeling process. We know loss of estrogen in women. Postmenopausally seems to increase their risk of bone loss. And men, by the way, who have low estrogen levels or who have estrogen receptors that are genetically unable to receive the estrogen message from their bodies, men will also sustain a risk to osteoporosis just like women. And we often forget about older age men having spontaneous fractures, but although less frequent than women, it is also a troubling problem in men as well. So all of these hormonal, endocrinological, gastrointestinal, nutritional, lifestyle variables play roles, obviously, in maintaining bone reserve. What is more interesting, I think, in terms of the new evidence is the role that the immune system plays in this process. And this may be somewhat newer information for you. It doesn't negate or diminish the significance of the endocrine system, the parathyroids and thyroids and kidney and liver function that we'll be speaking about in greater detail in this month's issue. But it also suggests there's an immunological cascade. Now, why am I suggesting this? We now recognize that individuals who have increased bone turnover, this is particularly seen in cases where you have an arthritic condition that's associated with increased loss of bone reserve, they have increased interleukin 6 levels as found in their blood. This pro-inflammatory cytokine seems to play a role in the developmental states of the osteoblast and osteoclast. Now, the osteoclast is the bone resorbing unit, right? The cell that's involved with bone resorption. And the osteoblast is the bone formation unit, osteogenesis. And it appears as if these inflammatory cytokines play a role in the developmental physiology of the osteoblast, the bone forming unit, being converted to the osteoclast, the bone resorbing unit. Therefore, if you have very high levels of inflammatory mediators, it increases then the relative population of your bone resorbing units at the expense of lowered levels of your bone formation units. And what does that do? It trips the equilibrium balance towards increased bone resorption. So with that in mind, you see reports in the literature like a 2003 report in the journal Arthritis and Rheumatism entitled The Role of Interleukin 6 Family of Cytokines in Inflammatory Bone Turnover. And in this particular paper that appeared in volume 48, page 1177, the authors talk about the fact that both interleukin-1, tumor necrosis factor, and interleukin-6 are all seemingly involved with increasing cell signaling that has to do with bone resorption, calcium resorption. Now, the reason I'm spending so much time belaboring this point is that I want you to recognize that skeletal mass, although we might think of the skeleton as that dead thing that's hung up in the corner of our biology class in school, is a very active dynamic tissue that's reflecting all sorts of neuroendocrine immunological changes that are occurring over time. And therefore, it's not just the absorption of calcium or the dietary calcium or even the endocrine control of calcium, but it's also the immunological control of where calcium is placed or how it's mobilized based upon these cell signaling processes at the osteoblast and osteoclast. So there are pro-inflammatory Th1 cytokines like IL-1, TNF-alpha, IL-6 that seem to participate in the activation of bone resorption. In clinical conditions like arthritis, I'm speaking now at autoimmune type arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis, you have significant elevations of these cytokines. There is increase in risk to bone loss. Now you might say, but from our previous discussions, you would postulate that increased evidence of these inflammatory cytokines are related to other disorders that we associate with age, like coronary heart disease and cancer and various types of neurological problems, dementias. So are you saying that osteoporosis as a disorder might connect together with these other degenerative age-related conditions? Well, that's where functional medicine, I think, starts to play a very interesting role, because if we look at disorders not as individually compartmentalized diseases that have no interrelationship to any other disease, as if every page of the DRG, the diagnostic related groups, are independent variables that have no dependency on any other condition, then we're led to the false belief that somehow heart disease isn't connected to osteoporosis and isn't connected to arthritis and it's not connected to cancers and it's not connected to dementia. But if we look at underlying mechanisms that associate themselves with different cell signaling processes that alter the phenomics of the cells, the tissues, the organs, and therefore the outcome of the patient, then those mechanisms that are interrelated give rise to different predictive abilities and maybe different strategies for treatment than looking at each disease as if it was independent from all others. I hope this point is well understood, because I think it's a central feature that distinguishes functional medicine from a traditional pathophysiologically based medicine that's rooted in the diagnosis as the primacy of understanding. Now, why am I talking so much about these inflammatory mediators like interleukin-1 and tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin-6? It's because those are the same signal transduction modulators that are involved as associated risk factors in things like coronary artery disease and in presenile dementia. So we haven't changed the names of the players. These mediators, these cell signal activators that send signals at a distance in the body from one tissue to another, are shared commonly across different diseases, meaning that maybe we have artificially distinguished the disease one from the other rather than looking at the commonality of mechanisms. And then tie that together with unique genetic susceptibilities or sensitivities. You know, you might say, well, why does one person have osteoporosis, another person heart disease, and another person dementia? They don't have necessarily all three all the time. And the answer to that would be related and rooted in genetic uniqueness of the way that these tissues express their different characteristics. But there can be similar mechanisms shared among them. So that then leads back to interleukin-6 and coronary artery disease. And in fact, there's a very interesting paper that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 286, page 2154, the title of which was Inflammatory Markers in Coronary Artery Disease, Let Prevention Douse the Flames. And in this particular paper, they go on to talk about the fact that elevated interleukin-6 levels were a strong and independent predictor of mortality for patients treated in both the invasive and conservative arms of a clinical trial related to coronary artery disease, and interrelate then with elevated inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein, particularly the high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, and things like myeloid peroxidase levels. We're going to speak more to that in just a moment. But IL-6, the same signal transduction agent, intercellular mediator that I was describing that's involved with cell signaling in bone turnover that leads to increased conversion of osteoblast to osteoclast and the resorption of bone, is also involved with signals that are related to the etiology of coronary artery disease. Now, similarly, we find that the activation of these cell signals that are involved with inflammatory processes then trigger other cascades of events, and this is where the process becomes very exciting, because the cascade of these events may differ from tissue to tissue and how they ultimately play themselves out into the phenotype. But one of the things that is associated with elevated IL-6 levels is increased myeloid peroxidase levels. And myeloid peroxidase levels are also associated independently with the risk of coronary artery disease. Now, what is myeloid peroxidase? That's an enzyme. Some people have called this the Klebanoff reaction that has been named after its discoverer, Dr. Klebanoff at the University of Washington, a pathologist who found that the way that immune system works in defending itself, the body against invaders like bacteria, is through a form of chemical warfare that engages bleaching the invaders to death. Bleaching meaning production of hydrogen peroxide and then subsequently other oxidants from the immune system. And this is actually a selective microbiocidal mechanism that cell-mediated immune defense participates in, is the release of hydrogen peroxide at a special area of contact with a cell surface reactive material like a gram-negative bacterium or a virus. And this bleaching event, this is like conducted oxidation, causes destruction of the cellular machinery, lyses the cell or something of that nature, and is a part of the defense mechanism. The enzyme that's involved with the production of these oxidants, one of those enzymes is called myeloperoxidase. It's found in very high levels in white cells. Myeloperoxidase is an enzyme that produces, as a byproduct of its reaction, an activated form of oxygen called hypochlorite, or OCl- for those of you that are chemically inclined. Hypochlorite is what's found in bleach. Sodium hypochlorite is the basic component of bleach. So when we talk about bleaching the cells, we're really referring to hypochlorite, which then can undergo secondary conversions into a variety of other oxidants, including such things as superoxide and singlet oxygen and hydrogen peroxide. And it's been found, as I mentioned, that elevated activity of myeloperoxidase in white cells is associated with an increased risk of coronary artery disease, suggesting that, again, an overactive oxidative Th1 immune system can not only increase the risk of bone loss, but increase the risk to atherogenesis. I'm quoting right now from a paper entitled Association Between Myeloperoxidase Levels and the Risk of Coronary Artery Disease. This is the Journal of the American Medical Association, page 286, page 2136, which describes this relationship. So there may be processes that then interrelate different disease types that are more helpful in us understanding how to proceed on therapy than just treating the individual disease as if it was working independently and in isolation from other disorders. I hope that you are understanding where I'm trying to take this functional medicine concept and strategy. Now let's take an example of such a therapeutic agent that would cut across diseases and more speak to mechanisms. And there are many examples of this, but I'm going to choose one that has been in the news recently in the scientific press that I think is quite fascinating. And that's the most simple of all amino acids, where the R group of that amino acid is a hydrogen. So this is the one amino acid that doesn't have a D and an L form. And I think you already know the amino acid I'm speaking to. It's glycine. Glycine is a very interesting amino acid because it shows anti-inflammatory, immunomodulatory, and cytoprotective effects. Even though it's this very, very simple organic chemical structure, glycine has influences on cellular physiology across a wide range of functions, anti-inflammatory, immunomodulatory, and cytoprotective. Now, in saying that to you, based upon my previous discussions about the way the immune system works and these Th1 pro-inflammatory cytokines as cell messengers and how they can activate things that are involved with oxidative processes, could you come up with a hypothesis as to how glycine could cut across those conditions that are associated with inflammation, immune dysfunction, and cell death? You might start to say, well, it must have something to do with that process, that cell signaling process. Maybe I should be looking then for all the disorders that associate themselves with those cell signaling processes that have gone awry, and maybe then glycine would be a central therapeutic agent that might be useful for those conditions. See, this is a reverse logic as to how do we approach then the evaluation of therapies for a functional medicine strategy. So let me speak specifically to glycine just so I can bring you up to speed here. Glycine protects against shock caused by hemorrhage, endotoxin, sepsin. It prevents ischemic reperfusion injury and cold storage reperfusion injury in a variety of tissues and organs, including liver, kidney, heart, intestine, and skeletal muscle. It's known to diminish liver and renal injury caused by hepatic and renal toxicants and drugs. Glycine also protects against polysaccharide-induced, this would be LPS, lipopolysaccharide-induced arthritis, and inhibits gastric secretion and protects the gastric mucosa against chemically and stress-induced ulcers. Are you starting to get the drift of where I'm going with glycine? you're going to say, now hold it, this looks like one size fits all. How can one simple compound, one amino acid, have all those remarkable effects? Because there are many diseases you've just mentioned, Jeff, and those are all independent. So how can one agent have effects on all of it? Sounds like snake oil. Well, we won't even go to snake oil in discussion of the omega-3 fatty acids found in snake oil that might have cut across many diseases too. I'll just speak specifically to glycine and say maybe it's not the diseases that we're interested in again. Maybe it's the mechanisms that relate to the etiology that relate then to altered cell signaling, for which glycine has some effect on normalizing cell signals. So that's a hypothesis I want to come back and explore with you. So glycine, obviously, from what I've just described to you, appears to exert several protective effects, which cut across its anti-inflammatory potential, its immunomodulatory potential, and its direct cytoprotective actions. It seems to act on inflammatory cells, such as macrophages, within the immune system. These are the cells, as you know, that are engaged in the hand-to-hand combat and secrete the Th1 cytokines, the various chemical signals that I've been describing, like IL-1, TNF-alpha, and IL-6. And that glycine acts on these macrophages to suppress activation of transcription factors and the formation of free radicals and inflammatory cytokines. Oh boy, let me just stop parenthetically with my fast-paced delivery here and say, isn't this interesting? A simple amino acid may have the ability to speak to the genes in such a way as to modify gene expression patterns through protein synthesis and activation of metabolism into the phenomics, into the phenotype of the cell or tissue or individual, so that it can arrest an out-of-balance immunological system, one that shifted towards pro-inflammatory states with increased release of these cell signals that are associated with oxidative injury and oxidative stress. Well, that's a big, huge step forward in understanding how nutrients or agents can modulate function beyond just filling the gap of deficiency. I can assure you, nowhere in the discussion of the original minimum daily requirements or RDAs for any nutrient was this discussion ever brought up. The reason being is that no one knew about this. This is very, very remarkable breakthrough information over the last 10 to 15 years with the discovery of the Book of Life, the human genome, and its factors that modify its expression. So again, glycine seems to act on inflammatory cells like macrophages to alter the activation of transcription factors, which then subsequently produces these cell signaling molecules like inflammatory cytokines that increase free radical and oxidative stress. In the plasma membrane, it's known that glycine appears to activate a chloride channel that stabilizes and polarizes the plasma membrane. We also recognize that in the neurological system, glycine has an agonist-induced effect on the L-type voltage-dependent calcium channels, and the resulting increases in intracellular calcium ions are suppressed, which may account for its immunomodulatory and inflammatory effects of glycine and its potential role in animal models for prevention of neurologic injury. And it's also, as you probably recall, been reported in the Journal of Psychiatry a couple of years ago. We actually reported this in Functional Medicine Update, that there are a group of patients who have schizophrenia who do not do well at all on the traditional anti-schizophrenia medications that, when placed on oral glycine, have a significant improvement in their function, and it potentiates the action of these medications. This is just one kind of simple example of one nutrient that cuts across mechanisms that influences many different functions across different disease states. So I think that what we're really talking about, if you want to look at metaphors, let's look at the whole system as a very complex transportation system, right? Like the old railroads of days of America gone by. And we got a problem in the transportation system. The cars are not getting to their final destination. They're having difficulties. They're breaking down. And so we bring in the management team saying, well, we got to go to these stations where the railroad trains are to get to, because there's obviously a defect in what's going on in scheduling. We got to look at the executives, and we got to figure out exactly who's at fault and who's at blame here, rather than sending someone out to the rails to see if the rails are intact and the cars are either flying off the rails or they're having a rocky trip. They can't go at the normal speed. They're producing a lot of heat on the tracks or having flame outs in their tender boxes. you know, sometimes you need to look at the rails, which is the mechanism of transportation. And that's where we're going here with the discussion of these cell signaling substances. Now, what amount of glycine are we talking about just from a clinical perspective? The doses of glycine can really vary depending upon different applications, like improving the ability to engage in liver protection with detoxification. Intakes of, say, 3 to 12 grams have been reported in the literature. When we talk about the effects in terms of brain biochemical function, doses may be higher than that, 10 to 20 grams of glycine. So there can be a wide range of different glycine intake. And again, it's a fairly safe nutrient, very broad range of safety. And we would look for individual characteristics that would define who could benefit from increased intake of glycine, not one size fits all. Because it's been shown useful for some, then everybody should suddenly start taking huge amounts of glycine. That's not the outcome from what we're discussing. So glycine, a novel anti-inflammatory immunomodulatory and cytoprotective agent. There's a wonderful review on this, by the way, that those of you who want to follow up in greater detail, that appeared in the Current Opinions in Clinical Nutrition and Metabolic Care, Volume 6, page 229 in the year 2003. Well, let's look at another interesting signaling molecule that relates to diabetes, insulin, and possibly has an interrelationship with obesity, and that's the peroxisome proliferated activated receptor family, PPAR, peroxisome proliferator activated receptor family, alpha, beta, and gamma. These newly recognized nuclear orphan receptor superfamily transduction agents are very important parts of the cell signaling process that leads to the expression of certain genes that are interrelated with energy economy, mitochondrial function, fatty acid metabolism, and insulin sensitivity. As you know, as we'll be talking much more about, this maturity onset or type 2 diabetes is a growing epidemic. We call it a pandemic because it cuts across all ages, affecting an estimated 16 to 20 million people in the United States alone. It's felt that an additional 16 million people in the U.S. have their pre-diabetic condition or so-called impaired glucose tolerance, which in the literature has been abbreviated IGT. In both type 2 diabetes and IGT, cardiovascular disease is known to be the leading cause of morbidity and premature death. This increased risk of macrovascular disease in both the type 2 diabetes and the so-called impaired glucose tolerance state is intricately associated with the presence of insulin resistance. And we know that insulin resistance, from extensive discussions we've had with Dr. Gerald Reaven, the father of Syndrome X, refers to an impaired ability for the body to respond appropriately to insulin and utilize glucose. And our symposium that will be held next May in 2004 in Vancouver, British Columbia, will deal extensively with the increasing amount of basic science and clinical science that underpins the understanding of the etiology of this type 2 diabetic condition. One of those contributors, which is emerging, has to do with, again, cell signaling, and in this case has to do with the peroxisome proliferated activated receptor family, specifically through its influence on gene expression. And that is how the mechanism of some of the aspects of insulin resistance might be seen, by altered signaling through these PPAR substances. And as you probably recognize, there are both agonists that activate the peroxisome proliferated activated receptor, specifically the alpha, beta, and gamma forms, and there are antagonists that inactivate selectively, and that this may be tissue-specific. Now, how does this interrelate then to a model that's emerging around insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and type 2 diabetes? Well, this is, once again, the genes and environment model that we've talked about so many times. Genetic influences and environmental influences tie together to give rise to the expression of insulin resistance. Insulin resistance increases insulin levels, so you get into a hyperinsulinemic state. That then has adverse impact on glucose tolerance, on triglyceride synthesis, leading to hypertriglyceridemia. It decreases HDL synthesis, so you get lowered HDL levels. You get increased small, dense, atherogenic LDLs. You have an adverse effect then on plasminogen activator inhibitor 1. It goes up, and that then has a direct effect on chemotaxis of white cells and attachment to the endothelium, which then is an etiological factor leading ultimately to transmigration, to foam cell formation, to LDL oxidation, and using the Steinberg model, leading to atherosclerosis. So we see this very complex interweaving of genes, environment, endocrine function, immunological function, and ultimately the expression of cardiovascular disease. The peroxisome proliferated activated receptor family are a series of signaling molecules that play a role in this whole process. And it's that particular association that is gaining much more interest in basic science over the last few years, particularly as a consequence of the discovery of a family of drugs that you know called the thiazolidinediones. And the thiazolidinediones, the first one that came to market was Resulin, which was subsequently removed from the market because of liver toxicity. But these thiazolidinediones drugs are those that activate or serve as agonists for the peroxisome proliferated activated receptors. Now, it turns out that there are being discovered a number of other substances that can serve as partial agonists or activators of these PPARs and have selectivity among the alpha, beta, and gamma families of PPARs. And many of these are nutritionally derived, things like omega-3 fatty acids, for instance, and possibly conjugated linoleic acid, or CLA, is another one that has been associated. So there's a lot of attention being placed on PPAR-modulated pathways. And in fact, the PPAR pathways are nuclear receptors that appear to be at the crossroads between lipid metabolism and inflammation, once again bringing this mechanism for conditions that cut across so many organs, like bone, brain, heart, kidneys, colon, prostate, and breast, that all have inflammatory components associated with their pathology, all back to maybe insulin signaling, PPAR signaling, and the interrelationship with these inflammatory mediators. Peroxisome proliferated activated receptors, just to review, are ligand-activated transcription factors that belong to this nuclear receptor family. They've been called orphan receptors because people didn't really understand exactly how they were functioning. They weren't a member of the steroid hormone family receptors, which were considered where the action was until a few years ago. PPARs function as regulators of lipid and lipoprotein metabolism. They also are involved with glucose homeostasis and influence cellular proliferation, differentiation, in apoptosis or cell death of transformed cells. PPAR alpha is highly expressed in tissues such as the liver, muscle, kidney, and heart, where it stimulates the beta oxidation of fatty acids and leads to their metabolism. PPAR gamma, on the other hand, is predominantly expressed in intestine and adipose tissue, and PPAR gamma triggers adipocyte differentiation and can promote lipid storage. The hypolipidemic fibrates, for instance, and other anti-diabetic glyphosone drugs are synthetic ligands for PPAR alpha and PPAR gamma, respectively. Furthermore, we know that fatty acids and eicosanoids of the omega-3 family are natural PPAR ligands, and therefore we can start to see some interrelationship between diet and environmental factors and the cell signaling through the PPARs, the peroxisome proliferated activated receptor family. PPAR activators exert anti-inflammatory activities in different immunological and vascular cell wall types, such as monocyte, macrophages, endothelial, epithelial, and smooth muscle cells, in which the PPARs are known to be expressed. These findings obviously indicate, then, a modulatory role of PPARs in the control of the inflammatory response, with the potential implication, then, as I've mentioned, across many different types of diseases that may only secondarily be associated with insulin or disinsulinism or hyperinsulinemia. These are conditions associated with bone formation, neurological functional difficulties, cardiovascular disease, kidney, colon, prostate, and breast cancer. Now, these are very interesting and probably, again, for most of you strange bedfellows to connect all these pathologies together under a single cell signaling mechanism. And I don't want to reduce this so simplistically to suggest that if we understand PPARs, we understand everything about those diseases. It's only a part of the complex network of cellular signaling, much more of which we will learn throughout the next several months on Functional Medicine Update. But certainly, PPARs is emerging to be an important part of this family. There's a wonderful review on this, by the way, that appeared in the journal Inflammation Research, volume 49, page 497. We know that PPARs play a very important role in the etiology of atherosclerosis, again, talking about the connection between heart and insulin and diabetes of the type 2 type. Wonderful review in this area, Trends in Molecular Medicine, Volume 8, page 422 in 2002, talks about how the emerging understanding of PPAR alpha and PPAR gamma and the protection against atherosclerotic disease is seeming to be part of a major research emphasis. We know that the vascular inflammation is modified both in vitro and in vivo as a consequence of PPAR gamma activators. And there is very strong evidence to indicate that these PPAR gamma activators inhibit the expression of adhesion molecules like vascular adhesion molecule 1 and intracellular adhesion molecule, two molecules that we talked about at our symposium in Tucson that are associated with atherogenesis. So I hope you start to see the origin and the formation of a model using cell signaling to define new therapeutic strategies. Well, as you know from our previous years, we always look forward to this section of Functional Medicine Update where we speak with either a clinician or researcher of the month. This month, we're very fortunate actually to have one person who can, I think, fit both bills, both as a fundamental researcher and as a clinical person with clinical research interests, Dr. Michael Hollick, who is at the Boston University School of Medicine and is a very, very active investigator over a 20-year period plus in the area of vitamin D physiology and biochemistry and relationships to clinical medicine. And this is an area that I was talking with Dr. Hollick briefly that we have really, I think, not done a good job over the past 22 years in Functional Medicine Update. It's a critically important area in clinical nutrition and an area that, shame on us, we really haven't done the appropriate job in bringing to your attention. So I guess, as Dr. Hollick said, better late than never, and we went to the horse's mouth to a person whose publication record in this area is absolutely stellar and has been a fundamental contributor over the past 20-plus years to this field. And so I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Hollick, to Functional Medicine Update and maybe just start off by asking, what is the history of vitamin D kind of in a nutshell to bring our listeners up to speed?
Sure. My pleasure, Jeffrey, to be on your program. You know, the vitamin D story really begins 300 years ago as the Industrial Revolution began to take hold in Northern Europe and these children lived in sunless alleyways. They developed rickets. And it would take another 200 years to appreciate that it's exposure to sunlight that's critically important for the production of vitamin D in the skin that ultimately will prevent rickets in children and also maintain good health in terms of bone health and maybe even cancer prevention in adults.
As we look at the interesting evolution of vitamin D, I think it's fascinating, this photochemical connection, which probably is why your appointments at Boston University School of Medicine are professor of medicine, dermatology, and physiology. Some people may not understand how that's connected together also to your directorship of the Bone Healthcare Clinic. It sounds like, boy, those are a lot of different hats to wear, but they all do interrelate with the history of vitamin D.
That's correct. In fact, we had done some studies and showed that even some of the earliest life forms, phytoplankton, have been photosynthesizing vitamin D on the Earth for over 750 million years. And we now realize that when you're exposed to sunlight, it's the ultraviolet B portion, which is the most energetic portion of the sun that penetrates to the Earth's surface, that converts the precursor of cholesterol, 7-dehydrocholesterol, not directly to vitamin D, but to pre-vitamin D. Once pre-vitamin D is formed, and it's formed specifically in the membrane of the skin cell, it immediately transforms into vitamin D, is kicked out of the cell into the extracellular space because, as you're aware, most vitamin D is produced in the epidermis, which is bloodless, and then it enters into the bloodstream where it then journeys for its first hydroxylation in the liver.
I guess a kind of a clinical question I've heard people bring up is if there is photochemistry that's involved with the formation of vitamin D in the skin, what about the trend towards reducing the risk to skin cancer with the high SPF sun creams?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And we know, for example, typically for natural sunscreen, i.e. skin pigmentation, melanin, most African Americans are vitamin D deficient because they have such good sun protection. We've done a study and showed that if you wear a sunscreen with an SPF of 8 properly, it reduces your ability to make vitamin D by more than 95%, really very similar to African Americans, and puts people at risk for vitamin D deficiency. So what to do? It's, I think, very simple, and that is that you don't need to bake in the sun to make lots of vitamin D. You only need probably no more than 5 to 10 minutes of exposure, 2 to 3 times a week, is usually more than adequate to make enough vitamin D.
What area of your skin, surface area, needs to be exposed in order to produce that effect?
Exactly. And we did a study in medical students. We had them in a bathing suit in a winter, and we brought them upstairs to our clinical research center and put them in a tanning bed to mimic sunlight. And if you're wearing a bathing suit and you expose your body to what's called a minimal erythemal dose, a light pinkness to your skin, not a sunburn, it's equivalent to taking 20,000 units of vitamin D a day. And so if you expose 6% of your body's surface to 1 MED, it's equivalent to taking about 600 to 1,000 units a day. which is what most experts, including myself, believe is what you need if you're not exposed to sunlight.
Oh, that's fascinating. Thanks. That really gives us some clinical perspective. I presume that you must have gotten interested in this topic at some level with your place of residence for both your PhD and your MD being University of Wisconsin, because I recall that a lot of the early work was done at the University of Wisconsin.
That's correct. I was very fortunate to work with Dr. DeLuca, and my PhD thesis was actually the isolation and identification of 125-dihydroxyvitamin D3. My roommate and I then spent 2 years, and we were the first to chemically synthesize it. And then when I was in medical school, I had the opportunity to collaborate with investigators, so we were the first to report the efficacy of 125-dihydroxyvitamin D to treat renal osteodystrophy.
Well, that's very exciting, because that takes us from the kind of way that a lot of people have learned about vitamin D as a vitamin to the more, I think, contemporary view that it's a prohormone, and this conversion of its prohormonal form, the cholecalciferol, into the hydroxylated derivatives is really where it mitigates its action. Could you tell us a little bit about that hydroxylation?
Sure. Once you make vitamin D in your skin or you ingest it in your diet, it has to go to the liver, where it's converted to 25-hydroxyvitamin D. It's the major circulating form of vitamin D. It's the form of vitamin D that clinicians should be using to measure vitamin D status of their patients. It then leaves the liver, enters the circulation, and goes to the kidney, where it's activated in the one position to form 125-dihydroxyvitamin D. And it's 125-dihydroxyvitamin D that then is recognized by its specific receptors in the intestine to increase the efficiency of intestinal calcium absorption, and it goes to your bone to mobilize calcium stores from the bone. So contrary to what people think about vitamin D as being critically important for bone health and that it has a direct action on causing the mineralization of bone, the true function of vitamin D is to make sure your blood ionized calcium is normal. And if you're not getting enough calcium from your diet, you will remove it from your bone, and vitamin D helps in that process.
Of those two hydroxylase enzymes, the liver enzyme and the kidney enzyme, is there anything known about which of those is more sensitive to, say, metabolic acidosis or various inhibitors that could interfere with the transformation?
Yeah, it turns out that the liver has such a large capacity to hydroxylate vitamin D that unless you have either severe fat malabsorption and are not absorbing vitamin D, or probably more than 90% of your liver is dysfunctional, you're capable of being able to metabolize vitamin D to 25-hydroxyvitamin D. The kidney, on the other hand, is different. It is quite sensitive and tightly regulated in its ability to make 125-dihydroxyvitamin D. Parathyroid hormone is certainly a good example. High blood phosphorus will shut down this hydroxylation, and low blood phosphorus will turn it on.
So can we say anything about those that might have chronic kidney disorders and their relationship to their vitamin D status, or is there nothing that can be correlated between the two?
In fact, there is. Now that we know that phosphorus is critically important, often patients that develop mild to moderate renal failure, they'll raise their blood phosphorus level because they can't clear it. This shuts down the renal production of 125D. This then leads to a decrease in intestinal calcium absorption, which leads to an increase in the production and secretion of parathyroid hormone, leading to secondary hyperparathyroidism. So what's critically important in early to moderate renal failure is to control the phosphorus level, and that's usually done by giving oral calcium carbonate with meals to try to bind it so that it doesn't get absorbed. Once you've reduced your kidney function by more than two-thirds, your kidney can no longer make an adequate amount of 125D to satisfy your body's requirement. And therefore, you need to be either on 125-dihydroxyvitamin D3 or one of the new active vitamin D metabolites that have recently hit the market.
And in the geriatric medical population, often you find them, particularly in nursing homes, being administered these vitamin D metabolites or salmon calcitonin. Is this a consequence of the kidney-related functional problems or just a complication of many other factors?
Yeah, I think that for the most part, nursing home residents should not be getting vitamin D metabolites, but they should really be getting vitamin D. Often what happens is that physicians will order erroneously 125-dihydroxyvitamin D because they think it's the active form, and so it's the form you should measure to determine vitamin D status. and it often comes back normal or even high, it does not give you any insight into the vitamin D status of the patient. It's only if they have really poor renal function should they be getting one of these vitamin D active compounds, because A, they're very expensive, and B, they can cause hypercalciuria and hypercalcemia and other complications.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. Let's move on from the kind of the classic view maybe of vitamin D related to the calcium dynamics into its emerging understanding in the immunological system. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. It turns out that activated B and T lymphocytes have receptors for 125D. We also know that 125D will alter the immune system in various ways. But I think more importantly is, how does this relate clinically? And the first insight was done in what are called NOD mice. These mice will routinely get type 1 diabetes after 200 days of life. If you pre-treat them with 125D, you prevent them, in 80% of the cases, from ever developing type 1 diabetes. Hipponen in Finland looked at children 1 year of age on and followed them for over 20 years. Those children getting 2,000 units of vitamin D a day reduce their risk of getting type 1 diabetes by 80%. We also know that there's a latitudinal association with multiple sclerosis, i.e., you live at a higher latitude, higher risk of developing multiple sclerosis. There's a mouse model that you can prevent them from getting multiple sclerosis if you pre-treat them with activated vitamin D. So we think that 125-dihydroxyvitamin D is a very important immune modulator, and that having an adequate vitamin D status is critically important for maximum immune function.
Is this role that vitamin D plays in the immune system part of the innate immune system modulation, they say the Th2 versus Th1, or do we know anything about that?
It seems to be innate in the sense that it regulates both antibody production as well as T-cell function.
That's very fascinating. So when a clinician asks you, does that mean that a woman who is pregnant should be supplemented with vitamin D, or an individual who may have had kind of relapsing MS, should they be given vitamin D? What do you tell them?
Two things. The first is all women who are pregnant should have their 25-hydroxyvitamin D levels drawn. We've just done a study at Boston Medical Center, and we found at least in African-American and Hispanic women, over 86%, both the infant and the mother, were severely vitamin D deficient as the infant was being born. In terms of MS patients, they often have muscle weakness. Vitamin D deficiency is often associated with muscle weakness and bone aches and pains. And so when we see patients with MS, we make sure that they have an adequate amount of vitamin D. We maintain their 25-hydroxyvitamin D levels of at least 30 nanograms per ml.
That's great. We're going to make note of these numbers in our summary cards so that people who are listening don't have to write it down. They can get it off their summary cards. One of the things that I know you've been actively involved with, as it probably interrelates with this immunological effect of vitamin D and its metabolites, is the relationship to psoriasis. And your publication record is quite interesting over the last couple of years in that area. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We now know that there are receptors for 125D in almost all tissues in your body. So you have to ask the question, why would that be? And since I was interested in the skin and its ability to make vitamin D, it was a big surprise to us back in the early 80s as to why your skin cells should have receptors for 125D. So what we did was we took skin cells, incubated them with 125D, and showed it's one of the most potent inhibitors of skin cell growth. So I put my MD hat back on and asked the question, is there a practical application? And of course, psoriasis came to mind. It's a hyperproliferative disorder of the epidermis. So we initiated the first clinical trials and demonstrated the therapeutic efficacy of topically applying the active form of vitamin D to treat psoriasis. And it is now considered to be one of, if not the treatment of choice worldwide. A variety of active vitamin D analogs have now been developed by pharmaceutical companies specifically to treat psoriasis.
That is very fantastic. Does this include things like congenital ichthyosis? That's not a strict psoriasis, but I have seen some anecdotal reports that vitamin D and A have been useful for that as well.
You're correct. Ichthyosis comes in various forms, and we, in fact, treated some patients with ichthyosis with activated vitamin D. Some responded extremely well, and others didn't respond at all.
Let me move from that to what, for me, maybe because of my molecular biology, interest is opening to be a fascinating chapter in our understanding of vitamin D, and that's its role as a member of the orphan nuclear receptor family regulator along with retinoic acid. Could you tell us a little bit about how you feel that research is evolving and whether it will assist us clinically to understand some of these mechanisms?
Well, we know that 125D interacts with its specific vitamin D nuclear receptor, but in order for it to unlock genetic information, it has to combine with retinoic acid X receptor. And then this complex sits on what's called a vitamin D responsive element on the DNA. It specifically recognizes this complex. And then a variety of transcriptional factors then start piling on top. And then this kind of sets up the engine to be able to transcribe the DNA into messenger RNA, which ultimately a new protein synthesis occurs. This is really important because we now realize that 125D is probably one of the most potent inhibitors of cell growth, and more importantly, of cancer cell growth. And it's been known for some time, in fact, as early as 1941, Apperly had published a very interesting paper in a Journal of Cancer Research. If you live at higher latitudes, you have a higher risk of dying of the many common cancers like prostate, breast, colon, etc. So if you lived in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, higher risk of dying of those cancers than if living in Texas, for example. And we've been doing studies looking at this in more detail, and what we found was it turns out that many cells in your body have the machinery to activate vitamin D. And we think that that activation process is responsible for the production of 125D that then regulates cellular growth and decreases risk of cells becoming cancerous, such as breast, colon, and prostate.
This is obviously one of those kind of watershed discoveries because it takes the understanding of vitamin D to a whole new level. Do you feel that this is at such a level that it's starting to move over from the research into the clinic, or are we still at the research level in this understanding?
Well, it's actually getting into the clinic because we asked another simple question, and that is, what about cancer patients? You know, they're often not feeling well, they don't go outside, they're on chemotherapy. Are they at risk of vitamin D deficiency? And is that vitamin D deficiency, A, making them not feel great, and B, maybe it's actually preventing their chemotherapy and other therapies from maximally working? So I got some medical students last year and had them collect blood from cancer patients. We found that almost 50% of patients with cancer at the end of the summer were vitamin D deficient. So we think that, in fact, this has direct relationship with human cancer and metastatic disease. We've also done a study in mice and have shown that if you give them colon cancer and you make them vitamin D deficient, they have very aggressive tumor activity. Whereas if you give the same tumor to animals that are vitamin D sufficient, it reduces metastatic activity by 55%.
And in tumor-bearing animals, do they still retain the appropriate hydroxylation pathways in their liver and kidney?
Yes.
Well, that's very, very interesting. You know, one of the other reports that I recall seeing, or actually was a couple of reports, was on the relationship between thyroid function and the retinoic acid receptor and interrelationship with the vitamin D metabolites. Is there a thyroid vitamin D connection that's emerging at all as well?
What we know is that the thyroid hormone receptor, the nuclear receptor, can interact with the vitamin D receptor in a heterodimeric fashion, just like with RXR. And so people are now beginning to think that if you have, say, a lot of vitamin A around and it's taking away the RXR, the retinoic acid X receptor, that maybe you can't have the vitamin D effect. And the same thing may be happening with thyroid hormone. There is this very complex interaction with many of these steroid-like hormones and the superfamily of nuclear receptors, i.e. the vitamin D receptor, retinoic acid receptor, thyroid hormone receptor, glucocorticoid receptor, etc.
So I may be jumping to too big a leap here, and please correct me if I am. If a patient has some indeterminate endocrinological disturbances, would it be wise for the clinician to evaluate their 25-hydroxyvitamin D just to see if it may be playing a role in this process?
Well, I would go one step further, and I'm beginning now to suggest that other experts are doing the same because we think that vitamin D has such an important role to play on overall health and welfare, that you should be getting a 25-hydroxy vitamin D level on your patients probably once a year, just like you do a cholesterol.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm sure that that's news to 95% of the individuals listening to this program, so thank you so much. Let me move on then to discuss the broad age-related disease relationship to vitamin D. We obviously have talked about the osteoporosis connection, but maybe you can tell us how you think these discoveries that have been made over the years relate to things like CVD risk and osteoporosis risk, some of the menopausal female health risks, just the general kind of broad brush, if we were able to address these, how we could impact some of these major public health issues.
Sure. In simple terms, vitamin D deficiency will, of course, cause secondary hyperparathyroidism. Therefore, you're removing both calcium and matrix from your bone. Therefore, you're putting more holes in your bones. Therefore, vitamin D deficiency will precipitate and exacerbate osteoporosis. In addition, vitamin D deficiency causes a mineralization defect of your skeleton, i.e. osteomalacia. And osteomalacia, unlike osteoporosis, which is a silent disease, osteomalacia can cause muscle aches and pains, both isolated and global bone pain. Many of these patients will see lots of different physicians, have a normal sedimentation rate, have a very large workup, only to find nothing wrong with them, and they wind up with the diagnosis of fibromyalgia. Our own experience and others is that probably 40 to 60% of patients with these types of symptoms are often chronically vitamin D deficient. And when you treat them with vitamin D and adequate calcium, you can sometimes see as much as a 25% increase in their bone density in 2 to 3 years, because all you're doing is you're finally mineralizing all of this osteoid that had been poorly mineralized because of vitamin D deficiency.
And how about some of the clinical symptoms that may have been assessed as nonspecific fibromyalgia? Do you see any improvement in those clinical pain scores?
Oh, what we tell the patients is that it takes often months to years to become severely D deficient and to develop osteomalacia. It often will take months to up to a year in order to correct that deficiency and for them to have significant improvement. I've had many patients that have been totally bedridden or wheelchair bound who after about 6 months to a year are now walking once again and totally free of their bone pain and even back to work. The way we treat vitamin D deficiency is not to give a mouthful of multivitamins. A, it's not going to work, and B, they're going to become vitamin A intoxicated. What you want to do is give 50,000 units of vitamin D once a week for 8 weeks to fill up the tank, and then to put them on 50,000 units maybe once or twice a month, depending upon their vitamin D status.
And do you give that intramuscular, or is that
no, orally.
Orally.
It's a pill, and it costs like $1 to $2 for each pill, so for like about $15, you can correct vitamin D deficiency.
So let me just make sure we got that right. It was 50,000 IUs per week, once a week for 8 weeks, and then grading down to once every month for the next couple months?
Right.
Could you tell us a little bit about the story of hypercalcemia and plant-derived vitamin D derivatives? Because I remember back when you had some work early on in that as well.
Yes. It turns out that it had been known for 30 years that cattle in South America, especially at the end of the summer, would wind up dying because they would calcify their heart and their major blood vessels, and they had severe hypercalcemia. And this was due to them eating a plant called solanum. And it turns out that this plant makes activated vitamin D and puts sugar on it. Now, why this plant does this, nobody knows. But it is an interesting natural source for 125-dihydroxyvitamin D.
As I recall, that plant family has other members that are edible plants like tomato and potato. Are there any of these same vitamin D derivatives found in those edible plants?
Right. It turns out that it's in the leaves, but not in the fruit or the vegetable. And so as a result, it's of little consequence. And as you probably are aware, that especially for tomato and potato, in fact, the leaves are often very poisonous. And that's part of the reason for it, probably.
What you shared with us is just fascinating. I mean, talk about densely packing a lot of information into the last 25 minutes. Is there anything you feel that we haven't covered that you'd like us to know about where vitamin D research and clinical application is going?
Sure. I think what's really exciting is that analogs of vitamin D are now being made that have a little effect on calcium metabolism, but have major regulatory activity, say, on cellular growth. So it's likely that vitamin D compounds will be developed to prevent and to treat some common cancers, may be useful to prevent and treat autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis and type 1 diabetes. And most recently, it's been shown that 125-dihydroxyvitamin D will inhibit the production of renin in the kidney. And it's been known for a long time that there's an association, again, if you live at higher latitudes, you have a higher risk of hypertension and cardiovascular heart disease. And we think that that may, in fact, be related again to activated vitamin D regulation of one of the major blood pressure hormones, renin.
Well, that is really fascinating, because obviously that would take us into the spectrum of discussing metabolic syndrome and whether there was any relationship between vitamin D physiology and some of the exacerbation of the hypertension and the renin-aldosterone connection, angiotensin connection found in metabolic syndrome. So
exactly. And also what's interesting, of course, in metabolic syndrome is that they often are obese. And we had shown that if you are obese, you're more likely to be vitamin D deficient. And the reason is that whether you ingest vitamin D or make it in your skin, it gets depoted in your fat, and it's not available in your body.
Well, you have given us so many pearls, we're all going to have to cogitate on this several times. I want to thank you for spending the time that you have with us. I've often said that we'd like to have news to use, and you've certainly delivered on that. I can only wish you just the very best in your continued research. I think this 25-year history sounds like it's really catching ahead of steam, and that we will be seeing a lot more about the vitamin D connection to clinical medicine.
Well, I thank you very much, Jeffrey. And because of my keen interest in really getting this message out, not only to clinicians but to the public, is that I've recently written a book called The UV Advantage, and it's going to be coming out next spring. And it really goes into great detail about all of these issues, about how you can actually get safe sun. And so I have tables at the end of the book where I point out anywhere on the globe, any time of the year, at any season, how long you need to stay outside to get enough sunlight to make an adequate amount of vitamin D.
Oh, that's going to be a very helpful book. If you could share when that publication date is near, we'll make sure that our listeners are reminded, because I'm sure this will be a very valuable addition to their library.
It would be my pleasure to do so.
Thank you once again. The best to you in your continued work.
Thanks so much, and to you too.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Dr. Hollock left us with an unbelievably interesting concept in medicine. And beyond the specificity of vitamin D and its metabolites, the hydroxylated derivatives, was this general theme that small molecules, when properly activated, can set signals across different tissues that result in either the prevention of or the increased prevalence of specific diseases. And these diseases may be varied in their type. And you'll notice that in his presentation on vitamin D, he spoke to the same family of organ-related disorders that I've been speaking to as it relates to previously the peroxisome proliferated activator receptors. He talked about problems in bone, in brain, in heart, kidneys, colon, prostate, and breast. So are there shared similar signaling mechanisms that require multiple agents for their support and control? For instance, we know in inflammation that you need both first signal messengers and second signal messengers to elicit a phenotypic inflammation. First signal messengers would be those that come from the Th1 cytokines, like interleukin-1, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and interleukin-6. We now know that the particular outcome of an inflammation then requires those first signal messengers to trigger a second signal process that involves nitric oxide and activation of cyclooxygenase and the release of eicosanoids, the pro-inflammatory eicosanoids, leukotrienes, and prostaglandins. And it's the relationship of all those together that will ultimately then give rise at the cellular level to the phenotype called inflammation. So there are multiple cell signaling processes that go on, not just a single messenger. And I think this is where the story becomes both interesting and confusing. And then you start talking about what is it that triggers the expression of genes that start this process going. And we're starting to learn of things that are called nuclear regulatory factors and reporter gene activators that are specific agents that can start these processes going through the release of the elaboration of the first signal messenger. So you have things like nuclear factor kappa B or AP1, these protein molecules that can then initiate specific cascade of events through gene expression and proteomic outcome and of metabolic functional changes that create the phenotype of altered cellular physiology. It is a whole new era, particularly when we start adding to that the recognition that lifestyle variables and thought, belief, attitudes, environment all can serve as modulators to these regulatory factors that are involved in cellular signaling. So let me go back, if I can, and speak just briefly to how the Dr. Hollick contribution related to vitamin D and its association with the prevention of bone-related disorders, skin-related disorders, heart-related disorders, the colon, prostate, and breast cancer also relates to insulin signaling and the peroxisome proliferated activator receptor family. I want to just summarize by saying that these PPARs also are part of this complex orchestration of altered cellular physiology in response to a stress. PPAR receptors, these ligand-activated transcription factors, which are a subfamily, the nuclear receptor family, including the vitamin D receptor and the retinoic acid receptor, RXR receptor, they all tend to work together as a team. PPAR activators have effects on metabolic risk factors and on vascular inflammation that's related to atherosclerosis. PPARs also have profound effect on the metabolism of lipoproteins and fatty acids and therefore cut across type 2 diabetes and the hypertriglyceridemia that's seen in metabolic syndrome and hyperinsulinemia. PPARs are activated by specific fatty acids, particularly omega-3 fatty acids, and also, it seems, conjugated linoleic acid, or CLA. The effects that PPAR then can be activated by fat seems very paradoxical. You mean specific fats can increase the metabolism of fats? That appears to be what is the case, that there's a signaling capability with certain kind of dietary fats. Omega-3 oils signal then the metabolism of other types of dietary fats to be used as calories for mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation or energy source. So there's this extraordinarily wonderful, beautiful, dynamic, complex, variegated relationship among all these signaling factors and messengers and triggers and agonists and antagonists that ultimately gives rise as it sweeps through the expression into the genes and then ultimately to the proteins and to the metabolism that we then observe clinically as the phenotype of the individual, for which we have simplistically categorized that as the disease. And the disease that we're going to claim that patient has probably is very similar to the bias or the preconception we have based upon our training, our pedigree, and our mentors. So in one family of investigators or clinicians, that might be seen as an arthritis. In another, it might be seen as a condition related to increased monocyte stickiness, pre-atherosclerosis. In another, it may be seen as preclinical dementia, depending upon where an individual looks. So what we're really talking about is taking this esoteric information from the research laboratory and trying to apply it in the clinic, knowing that if we're improving insulin sensitivity, we're reducing then serum circulating insulin levels, we're increasing then cell signaling stability so as to lower the inflammatory mediators, and we're seeing proper regulation of things like the metabolism of vitamin D, and wasn't that fascinating that we should be evaluating our patients by looking at the 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels in their plasma on a regular annual basis just to see where they are, because that's such an important signaling molecule. This is the pre-staging of a new form of medicine that we've been speaking to for some time, the functional medicine model. Now, taking this back again to the relationship between peroxisome proliferated activator receptors and atherosclerosis, I want to emphasize that these cell signaling messaging molecules don't have effects that are just singular in their action. For instance, PPAR gamma has profound effects on the differentiation and function of adipose tissue, where it's highly expressed in the genes of adipose tissue, the adipocyte. PPAR is also expressed in atherosclerotic lesions and macrophage. These are negative regulatory effects then of nuclear factor kappa B and activator protein 1 or AP1, which are also signaling pathways, interconnect the PPAR pathway with gene expression pathways and then lead downstream to the expression of oxidant stress molecules like through myeloperoxidase and the production of hypochlorite and hydrogen peroxide. So the endpoints are the oxidants. The upstream regulators are the cell signal messengers, which are modifiable in their production on the basis of environmental and physiological situations. PPAR gamma, as you probably also know, affects the recruitment of monocytes in vascular endothelial cells. The involvement of PPAR in atherosclerosis, a disease with chronic inflammatory character, suggests that these PPARs play a role in other inflammatory-related diseases and help quench inflammation, and therefore PPAR agonists may be, in fact, serving as general anti-inflammatory modulators. For instance, do we not think that omega-3 fatty acids are useful in arthritis? are useful in the prevention of neurological diseases, are useful for the prevention of heart disease, are useful for conditions that are associated with coagulation disorders. Might these all interrelate to the role that the omega-3s play in part through modulation of PPAR families, another immune modulation that leads to gene expression of these inflammatory mediators? I hope you see this as a different strategy than just finding the disease and finding the drug to modify the symptoms of that disease. We're looking at interconnected, shared, common mechanisms that are tied together with these common cell signaling substances. 25-hydroxyvitamin D is a common signaling substance shared among disorders of the bone, brain, heart, kidneys, colon, prostate, and breast. So are PPAR gamma and alpha. So do we see other cellular signaling molecules that are environmentally modifiable in their production that we'll be discussing over the course of the preparation for next year's Functional Medicine Symposium, the 11th International Symposium on Type 2 Diabetes. The review article, by the way, that I've been referring to that describes this interconnectedness of PPARs to all these inflammatory conditions is a nice paper that appeared in Biochemical Pharmacology, Volume 60, page 1245 in the year 2000. Now let's take this from the abstract to the applied in the last couple of minutes. What does this mean to you as a clinician? If you're measuring in that patient, in their plasma, things like high sensitivity CRP, or you're measuring triglyceride HDL ratio, which you see to be elevated, and you see an elevated CRP, let's say it's 4, with a normal upper limit of normal is 1.5, and you do a 25-hydroxyvitamin D level, and you find that it's 15 nanograms per milliliter, below the 30 nanogram per milliliter cutoff that Dr. Hollick was talking about, you start to develop a model, don't you, of where that patient may be that maps back against their clinical signs and symptoms. This takes us back to the patient-centered assessment model of functional medicine. Rather than looking at just pathophysiology, we're looking at antecedents, triggers, mediators leading to the signs and symptoms that the patient presents with. And these signs and symptoms can be of different severity, intensity, and duration. And so it helps us to develop a model based upon mechanisms, not just upon trying to find the diagnosis in that patient. From the mechanism, then we start to ask and recruit, what ways can we modify that mechanism based on what we know? What are the agents in our armamentarium of tools? What are the drugs? What are the nutrients? What are the lifestyle variables? What are the environmental factors that then can help us to modify these signal molecules that create then the outcome in phenomics of this cluster of signs and symptoms that we, for convenience, categorize as diseases so that we can get proper reimbursement for services? It is that model that is the functional medicine model that you've heard Dr. Hollick speak so eloquently to in this month's Functional Medicine Update. Whether he knows that his concepts and research of 25 years is consistent with what we've been talking about the last 11 years in functional medicine, I guess remains for further discussion. But certainly you can see in the minds and the dedication of many very competent researchers and clinical investigators that this concept of functionality preceding pathophysiology is emerging to be a dominant theme in the future of medicine. We'll look forward to being with you next month and look forward also for you putting on your calendar May 11th through 15th, 2004, for our 11th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, Diabetes, Type 2, a Pandemic.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.